This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is Robert Yoon, CEO and co-founder of Monograph, a project management platform built exclusively for architects and engineers, trained as an architect with dual master's degrees from University of Michigan. Robert spent over a decade designing for top E&A firms before turning his focus to software. So he's an architect who has turned to the tech world. In 2019, he co-founded Monograph to bring clarity and efficiency to firm operations, from budgets and forecasting to time tracking and profitability. Today, Monograph serves thousands of professionals and handles billions in project fees. Robert is a good friend of mine. He's a good friend of our community. He's been here on the podcast several times. He's done expert training sessions over at Entree Architect Network, and it is always a pleasure to talk with you, Robert. Welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me back. It's always been a pleasure, and I'm super excited to dig in today.
Yeah, what I thought we could do today, because I wanted you to come on a while ago, because you had a big fundraise for Monograph and took it to the next level. And I wanted to talk about that, and I think we will talk about that a little bit. But I put you on a schedule that was months after that happened. And so we're finally here today to have a conversation. And so a lot of people know about that fundraise at this point. But what I thought we can do is, you and I have known each other for a long time, and I knew you long before Monograph was Monograph. And so I've seen the journey that you've gone through as a business and as a friend, taking the idea of Monograph and starting it from scratch as a startup, and then growing it into what it has become today, which is a leading product that architects are using all over the world. Thousands of firms are using it. And I thought an interesting conversation would be to share that journey, to share the story of Monograph. How did you go from an architect to launching a software company to what it is today? And maybe even talk a little bit about where you think it might go in the future. Sound like a good plan?
Sounds like a good plan. I'm going to need your help a little bit on protecting the guardrails.
Yeah, I could do that.
If not, this conversation could go on forever. But Mark, I'm excited to share. Where do you want me to start?
Yeah, that's no problem. I've been podcasting since 2012. So I've been good at keeping people on the rails for a long time. So I think we could do that. I want you to start at the beginning, right? You went to University of Michigan for architecture. You became an architect. You started practicing. You worked for SOM, some other firms. How did you go from architect to software?
Oh my God. Like, well, that story is super complicated. And just for the record, I was never licensed.
Right.
Legally speaking, I wouldn't.
Not technically an architect, but
no.
But trained as an architect.
Trained as an architect, 2 degrees in architecture, a decade of experiences. I was just about to start my exams. And unfortunately, I was let go. And that took me down a number of different routes in terms of just like personal discovery. Who am I? Why? What am I going to be? I've never been let go before. So it was a huge personal setback for me. And the biggest reasons why I was let go was I wasn't able to commit the time to the practice. It was a small husband and wife firm in San Francisco. We were doing high-end residential work. But Mark, I think we were just introduced and I was flying every weekend to either Virginia or Tennessee or Boston to run workshops under Section Cut. I would take a red eye Friday night. I would land, I would teach really young minds at these universities on Saturdays and Sundays. I'll teach digital fabrication, robotics, and then I'll take another red eye back on Sunday to go back to work. It was a passion of mine to teach. It was a passion of mine to tinker with technology. And I didn't want to be a full-time teacher, but I loved the situation of occasionally on the weekends flying somewhere and running workshops.
And I think that's how we originally met. Our mutual friend, Marilyn Modinger, introduced us.
Yes.
And I think she was at the BAC at the time, or she was associated with the BAC at the time. I think, you know, became friends with you and thought, oh, this entrepreneur needs to talk to this entrepreneur and set that call up. And you and I just had an intro call and the rest is history these many, many years later.
She was a professor at the BAC. And that's
That's right. She taught at BAC, right?
Because I was doing workshops on the weekends at the BAC. And everyone, you know, I'm sure the audience knows when you have a deadline in architecture, well, that kind of makes things a little complicated where like I can't work the weekends and, you know, be flying across the country teaching. So there's no remorse against my old bosses there. It just wasn't the right fit. And they sent me down a path that I'm extraordinarily grateful.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. It's like, thank you very much.
But in the moment, it was really hard, right? Like, I think it's incredibly hard for any young adult or adult in general to say like, oh no, I got let go and I got to figure out what's next.
Also, knowing you as a friend, having known you for a long time now, I could not imagine how you felt when someone rejected you, when someone let you go. Right?
I'm highly competitive. I don't like failures. And like, it was a really hard time. It was a great learning moment because Section Cut at the time was doing well. It was my first foray into like, maybe I'll do this full time. Maybe there's a business idea around this.
Explain what Section Cut is or was.
It was. Monograph had the pleasure of buying the domain name and we've repurposed Section Cut today. But originally, it was a bookkeeping, bookmarking type of tool where anyone can essentially save their architectural-related resources. Originally designed for myself. Like, I finished Michigan, and I was working on my portfolio, and I realized throughout my tenure at Michigan, I have all these books that I've read, all these tools that I've learned, all these papers that I've either really appreciated or wanted to remember. And there's no real great way of, like, let's say, archiving that information and making sure that it was easily discoverable. Just dropping everything into a Dropbox folder or a box folder wasn't going to be very sufficient because I couldn't find it and couldn't keep it organized. So I started as a little side project as a bookmark tool for myself. It grew into a small community where a whole bunch of other people wanted to bookmark and it was free for anyone to use the tech to like bookmark their favorite reads.
I was on it.
And then an idea sparked over the summer. I was like, hey, like, there's so much material here. I can package this material and like kind of sell and do a little bit of teaching around, you know, topics that really interested me that I thought might be interesting for other universities. So that's where the whole idea of running workshops came to be.
Were your co-founders involved in that originally?
Yes. So I was the original founder. Then we brought on four co-founders. We were all classmates from Michigan. And I think we were all spending that summer working on our portfolio. And I was like, oh, like, this is fun. And like, why not have an excuse to meet once a week on, you know, on a phone call or chat and like keep the friendship going.
And so what happened to Section Cut?
Okay. So after I was let go, I decided to try and give it a go full time. There's a couple of things I've learned really quickly. Asking other people to do red eyes on the weekends is incredibly difficult. Near impossible, which actually caused a problem because I couldn't sign more universities was if I couldn't figure out how to like get, you know, young people who wanted to like teach on the weekends, but like also keep their full-time job.
Yeah. You had a scaling problem.
It was a terrible business problem. I think it was a fantastic idea with the right ethos of education. But as a business model, like I've learned about sales cycles. I've learned about unit economics. None of that made sense in that business model. Sales cycle, which is, if you don't know, that's how long it takes from like the day you start a conversation to the day you ink a contract. Architects, you should know that for your own business. This is part of like managing a pipeline and understanding how long does it take for you to go from start to finish. For university, it took over 12 months. Then it took another like 6 months to get paid because the vendor payment was like...
Not a great business model.
No. So you're looking at like a year and a half to 2 years before you can see your first paycheck. No, it was a terrible business idea. But I was so happy doing it because like it brought smiles to like young minds every weekend. I got to flex a muscle that I don't usually get to flex Monday through Friday. But terrible business. I think at the same time on a Halloween, I met my two co-founders of Monograph, Alex and Mo, at a Halloween party that they threw, not on Halloween, which gives you a little indication of like how quirky my two best friends are, is that they throw parties just for the sake of throwing parties. But obviously I talked about Section Cut. I talked about this project that I wanted to try to like work on. They're self-taught software developers, but they got their master's at MIT, incredibly smart, and had no intentions of being a traditional architect. And that's the beginning of a friendship between the three of us.
And so together, you launched Monograph, but it wasn't what Monograph is today.
No. So like before that, we launched an agency where we built software.
Right.
Remember, Mark, like this is the Dixon.
It's all coming back.
Well, one, I realized that Section Cut was a terrible business model. So like, okay, I can't do this anymore. But I'm also like now terribly in debt and unemployed. Alex was building websites for friends and family. So was Mo. Mo was building applications for friends and family. And they were all charging for friends and family rates. I think we were already having happy hour weeklies. And we looked at each other's eyes and like, this
isn't working.
And I think we should try doing something together. And one, I think they could have like easily tacked on another digit to their fees and we would look a lot stronger if we were together than as individuals. Our guess was right. So Dixon and Mo as an agency started. I ran all business development, operations and finance. Alex did a lot of design work and Mo did a lot of engineering work. One of our most famous clients was Figma back in the day. This was before Figma was a really big thing, but they hired us to do a whole bunch of work for them as consultants.
Which Figma recently became a public company.
They did. I'm really proud of Dylan, the CEO and founder. He's also an investor in Monograph. So they've come a really, really long way, but it's incredible to watch him grow and Figma as a company grow as well.
Yeah. So Dixon and Mo, an agency, designing websites. So that became a business.
That became a business. It was a profitable business because we were a services business. So like we just make sure that our budgets were tight, our time allocations were appropriately assessed, similar to architectural fees. And like we just want to make sure that our proposals and our fees match our total overhead. And we're actually doing substantially well. And we built a lot of side projects. If you remember, Mark, we did like HTML color codes. We did a bunch of SEO projects.
Color codes is still my go-to when I'm looking for a color code.
It's still an incredible project. Alex now 100% owns it. It was a time when we got to be very creative and we got to tinker a lot. We had a website builder already as a product. It was branded and structured as a blogger. We're trying to think of architects. We believed at the time that architects might want a blog to show off their work. And we've built all the functionalities of a website builder into a blogger. And the entire monetization strategy was similar to HTML color codes, which was ad-based. This was before I joined AlexML. My first question to them was, one, how do we make money? A takeaway from section, because I was like, hey, like, this is a really important question to ask.
Right.
How does this make money? And they were like, hey, so we're going to run ads. I'm like, okay, I don't think there's enough architects in the world for an ad model to make sense. So we did some research and it's like, it's not enough. We repackaged that product into the first version of Monograph, which was a Monograph website builder for architects. The code and the technology was very similar and we just had to repurpose it in a slightly different way.
And so it was a website builder.
Yeah.
So architects could basically sign on to Monograph, pay a fee, and you would guide them through the process of putting together a basic website.
Correct. It was very similar to, let's say, a Squarespace or WordPress or Wix. There's actually quite a lot of competition in the website builder and technology space. And that taught me a lot too. It taught me that there's a lot of competition. We didn't have a unique advantage of like, what can we do for our architects that's uniquely better and different that a WordPress couldn't or Squarespace couldn't. Mark, unfortunately, we didn't have a good answer for that question.
Yeah. Right. And by focusing exclusively on architects, it made it even more difficult.
Correct. Right?
Because you've marketed, which is typically a good idea, right? Niche down to a specific market, dominate the market, become the player.
Yep.
But if you limit your market and your market is very small relative to the world, you've created a very limited business model.
And so I would say most catchphrases are incomplete. It's incredibly valuable to niche down to a vertical. To finish that sentence is like, well, whatever you build should be very specifically and adds unique value to that vertical that no one else would do.
Interesting. Yes.
Right. If you don't complete that sentence, you actually don't know why it becomes a unique advantage to be very, very focused. A website builder that wasn't able to find unique value and unique things that we can give back to our customers that our competitors couldn't do wouldn't warrant a very verticalized specific tool.
Yeah.
If you catch the learning curve, like each learning curve is a little bit faster.
Yes.
We're learning a little bit faster.
That's why I wanted to tell the story, because I think it's a very interesting process, right? These young kids basically go out and try to start a business, learn a lot, fail.
Yeah. You know, we've tried a whole bunch of things and we had a lot of customers actually enjoy the product really well. And it was a really difficult decision and be like, hey, this might not work. It's highly competitive and like this is going down a direction that we don't know how to scale this business, or we might not be able to deliver on it being specifically for architects, which is actually even more painful for us. And then why do it at all? Because it didn't interest us to be another Squarespace or another WordPress.
Right.
So it's back to the drawing board.
So what was that like? Realizing that, right, that you started this another company that wasn't going to continue, right? There was a realization there that this isn't going to grow to the level that it needs to in order for it to be a viable business. So what do we do? Do we shut it down or do we pivot to something else? What was that thought process?
Well, it was three young adults that were very poor at the time. The agency was fine, but like we weren't taking any profits. Shutting things down really wasn't on the table.
It was not an option. It was making money, so you weren't going to shut it down because you needed the money.
Yes,
so
we knew we had amazing customers and people who really believed in us, and they found value in the product that we did build. We knew with confidence we couldn't scale it. So the move was not to shut it down, keep it going, and then go back to the drawing board, figure out one, what are we really passionate about, write it down, what problems really interest us and why, write that down, sit back, stare at that whiteboard for a while, drink a few beers. And somehow, like, I think it was actually a happy hour with a bunch of friends of ours, and all of our friends are architects, and kind of hit us over the head because it was the same conversation every Friday night. And it always starts with, like, I got a deadline. I can't stay very long. I got to work the weekend. Or I was like, the project is way over budget. I just found out we're just going to have to eat a big loss. or my boss is yelling at me for like how much hours that we spent on this, and we had no idea. And now, but the hours are already spent, so I don't know what to do next other than like, let's just enjoy the hour of happy hour, and then I gotta go back to the office tomorrow and finish up some work. This was a standard conversation every Friday night. Naively, the three of us were like, we can fix that problem. That's hard. It's actually a really hard problem.
That's easy.
I'm 6 years in, I'm still trying to fix the problem. But I think, you know, when you're young and you're naive, like, hey, it can't be that hard. It's obviously a project management problem. It's a time management problem. It's a financial management problem. Like, the tools can help here. They have for a lot of other industries. Why not architecture? So we ran back to the office and we started to get to work.
And so how did you transition from websites to project management?
Well, that conversation kicked us off. The product had to be rebuilt from the ground up. So that ensured that the original product was not going to get touched and the customer base there stays untouched.
So you just built them parallel.
Yeah.
Continued one, built
it. Years later, we still have customers on the website product. They've continued to pay into that product. We just have not touched it and we have not grown it.
Yeah. So what did it start as, right? Because it didn't start as what it is today. So what was the MVP, the minimum viable product?
Just timesheets. It was just a timesheet product. We realized that if you wanted to solve a project management problem, a financial problem, a time management problem, a financial problem for firms, you have to break things down to their atomic unit. Well, what's the one thing that everyone, doesn't matter which part of the industry you are, which size you are, what problem you're trying to solve, it kind of all anchors on one thing. If you like it or don't like it, then in the day, architecture is a services business and services is pegged to time. And we knew that really well because we were running a services business also as an agency. So as long as we start with time, we can expand. We can layer on and continue to layer. And we, 6 years later, we are continuing to layer on that premise that time is the atomic unit. Because time can be extrapolated to money and time can be extrapolated to like essentially fuel for your business. How you manage it, how you see it, how you use it. It starts with time.
So you launched with timesheets.
Just timesheets.
But how technically, strategically did you launch? Was it this sort of quiet seed a couple of friends with the initial product, or did you have a big launch say, hey, there's a new version of Monograph? How did you do that?
We went as big as we can. We also learned from the agency model and past projects where like going small when you're already small, you're essentially making a very small world tinier. It was fine to go as large and be as loud as possible. And obviously we have larger ambitions and we still have larger ambitions today.
Yeah.
But also be really upfront that all we had was a timesheet product. It was cheap and all it did was track your time. And we tried our best to go as loud as possible. And that usually meant I called every person I knew. Wasn't that many at the time. I text every friend I knew. I emailed wherever I can email. I'm proud to be a Michigan alum. So there was a large network behind me, which I'm really, really grateful for. And we had probably five customers within a month. Which was great because then it gave us a starting point to like test, iterate, and get some feedback.
So what was the next step after you did time? And actually, before we go there, you launched this minimum product. How big was the vision at that point? Because today you have a very, very big vision. How big was the vision when you first launched it?
The entire premise at the time was to bootstrap a business, have supplemental income along with the agency. So our appetite for vision wasn't huge. And at the time when we first launched, it was just like, hey, like I think architects can use something that can help them manage their time. We'll slowly add features along the way as the customer base grows and can self-fund itself and self-fund the R&D work. So the vision was very small at the time.
Very small. So was it at the time, was it a lifestyle business where you're like, oh, we're going to build this thing and we're going to make enough money to live comfortably? And we'll continue to iterate and make it a little bit better, a little bit better, make a little bit more money, a little bit more money.
Small steps, incremental. The core business was still the agency, but we wanted to shore up the agency around the edges in terms of like recurring revenue. Part of that was done via the ad projects that we were building, but we also wanted to do SaaS and Monograph at the timesheet version was a SaaS product that we can lean on.
What was the inspiration, or do you remember the moment when it went from this lifestyle product to, oh, this is a real business and our vision just got bigger? Was there a moment in time where that happened?
Yeah, there was that summer, well, it was like spring of 2019, my inbox got flooded. A bunch of architects wanting to learn more about the products and like get in and can use it. Absolutely looking for a tool to manage their timesheets. And like, I think we've hit something where tracking time on a spreadsheet just doesn't make any sense anymore. And if you didn't track time at all, that was also way worse. So we got a lot of inbound. And then I was spending all my time with architects and not chasing new work for the agency.
You gained traction.
We gained traction. And also Mo was like, hey, Robert, like, shouldn't you be looking for new work for the agency? Because like, you know, that's kind of what we need to pay our bills and pay our salaries. And I'm like, I have literally no time left. Like, I'm spending all my time on architects. And yes, this doesn't make a lot of money or at all at that point yet. But I think we got something here. And we have to make a decision, because I actually feel like this isn't like a small project anymore. This might be something that could be really, really big. And I want to give it a go.
What was that conversation like? Was everybody on board? When you brought that to your partners and said, hey, this thing's got some traction. I think this could become big. We're going to make a decision. We're going to pull some resources away from the agency that's making us our money right now and move our focus and our efforts and your time as the lead sales guy to this new product. What was that conversation like? Was everybody, let's go?
I wish the story was that clean, but like, life never works out that cleanly. Like, obviously they were 100% supportive and I love Alex and Mo, but the reality was also like, hey, like, we're three adults here and like, we live in one of the most expensive cities in the country.
San Francisco, by the way.
Yes. Like, so supportive, but with caveats, rather. You have to put some guardrails around this. Okay, we got to put it on a timeline. Can't work on this forever because like, that's just not how life works. We all have a little bit of money saved and we all have essentially lines of credit and credit card. How far do we want to go in the hole and for how long can we go in the hole for?
A very important conversation.
And do we feel comfortable? Like, we have to agree, like, it's going to hurt a bit and end up hurting for a long time, but like, it's still the right move. That conversation was not easy. But when you're working with your best friends, and this is how you know you're working with your best friends, you can have difficult conversations and you can make difficult decisions together. So we did that. And what we aligned on was we had until the rest of the year, 2019, the company was going to run out of money, but we all believed in ourselves that even if we did run out of money, we can kick things back up in 2020 if we needed to, and that we were all going to go into debt a little bit. We'll manage that debt appropriately. So that was a consensus decision. And then I went full speed into MarioGraph, trying to bootstrap it first for a few months, realized quickly that that's not possible without a little bit of funding. We already don't have enough because all allocated funding was to essentially pay ourselves for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
That kicked off our first seed round, which I think that started in the summer of 2019.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So you took the product of timesheets, showed some traction, built a plan, said, okay, with consensus with your co-founders saying, okay, we're going to shift our focus to this product. We have the rest of the year. We're going to build it into this next step, right? Which is what you're going to try to grow the company, grow the revenue of the company, and go for some seed round funding. So what does that mean? What does that mean when you say you're going to go for seed round?
So you can imagine to support, you know, a team of three, and we had Mark also, who was our employee on Dixon & Mo, so a team of four. If we use whole numbers here, like 100,000, that's 400,000 of annualized salaries that we had to figure out how to recoup and recoup quickly. On the first pricing model of MonoGraph, we were very cheap. I made a lot of mistakes in terms of pricing the product. There was no way we were going to make 400,000 in a year. So a lot of that money also came from Dixon & Mo and agencies to support, but it wasn't going to be enough.
Logistically, were these two separate companies?
Originally, no.
So this was a project of Dixon & Mo at this point?
Yes. As soon as we realized that the math doesn't math and we're going to need to put some cash into MonoGraph or it won't work, we incorporated. We took it out of Dixon & Mo and we incorporated MonoGraphic. As soon as we did that, I read everything I can, watched every YouTube video I can find on what, how do I raise a round? What is a round? What's a seed round? What is Y Combinator? Like, hey, like we're in San Francisco. There's a lot of material here. So I just went all in on like one, learning as much as I can, as fast as I can, and then took a stab at trying to raise a round.
What did that look like? So you decided you were going to do this. Did you have a number in mind? I mean, you could not be in a better place to raise funds. San Francisco, Silicon Valley is right there. Who did you talk to? How did you get that first round?
Well, I don't know any investors. All my friends were architects.
Who were not investors?
No. My family's extraordinarily poor. So, and we're, you know, my parents are immigrants. So like we don't have a network either. Similar with Alex and Moe's, it was like, okay, we're already in a severe disadvantage. Everything I've read suggest you start with family and friends round. Unfortunately, our family and friends are not in a place where we can have a family and friends round. We have to skip a step and go straight to institutional investors and try to raise what we've now known as a seed round, like seed money to get the business started. I think Mo sent out a tweet. I went on LinkedIn and found anyone that had a second degree connection to. I cold called, I emailed, did everything I can to get a meeting. I did that for about 3 months. I spoke to about 120 different investors who all said no before the first yes. So it was a lot of no's in 3 months. And then as soon as the first one said yes, 8 others said yes. And that was the completion of our $2 million seed round.
When the first one said yes and the others then started saying yes, was that because you could leverage the first yes? Or was it just that you got good at pitching and it became successful?
I think it's a combination of events. I do think if you try something 120 times and
you get good at it,
you're bound to improve. I wouldn't quite say you get good at it yet, but you're bound to improve. If you're going to do something that's so repetitive over and over again, it's no different than when you're in school and we had to learn how to draft and like your first exercise was terrible. You might not even know what a T-square was. And then eventually, you know, you learn the tools, you learn the skill, you eventually get good at it. So I got good at it. And the round came together towards the end. I just keep iterate every week. I sit down or write down notes. I'm like, why did I got no again? Who did I get a no from? Did I ask him immediately after they said no? I was like, hey, what can I do better? How did you make this decision? Why did you make it this decision? These are really important details for me because as long as they tell me how they made the decision and why they made the decision, then all I have to do is solve for that.
Right.
And theoretically, they would say yes. You do it 120 times, you pattern match. And, you know, you kind of rejiggled a little bit in terms of like how the business was positioned and pitched. And then the round came together.
Was there any time during that fundraise where you thought, this isn't going to work, I'm going to quit?
Every week.
So why did you keep going?
That's a really good question. I think there was a fire in me that believed that this can work. Mark, you've known me a long time. I don't like no's and I don't like rejections. And I like, if I'm stubborn, if I have a problem that I'm trying to fix, I really want to fix a problem. And the problem was I need to put $2 million in the company. I need to do it as fast as possible because we're literally going in debt every week. So I think it was just the personal fire in me. Just this, didn't want to quit. I felt like I was very close.
And that seed round was $2
million? Seed round was $2
million. And what did you end up using that for?
Put myself on payroll.
Right. For one, you got paid, right?
Yes. It's like, great. Now I have a salary and a little bit of pressure.
But you said you needed $400,000 for that and you got $2 million. What was the plan for the other 1.6?
Well, we needed $400,000 just to take care of the original team. And that was only on 1 year of salary, right? Like as soon as you go to like year two, now we're looking at like $1.2 million or $800K plus taxes and plus overhead. You're going to need to round up to about $900,000. And that doesn't include any type of headcount hiring. To build this, we're going to need to hire at least 2 or 3 software engineers. We're going to have to invest a little bit and we're going to need a runway that's a little bit longer than 2 years. You do the math and all of a sudden we were wrong in our initial estimate. The initial estimate only bought us the original team for 1 year and we kind of need 2.5 years to 3 years on a slightly larger team. And then you need to add in a little bit of buffer because you're going to make some experiments and you're going to make mistakes along the way and that's going to cost you. $2 million sounded like it was the right number for us to raise from the get-go.
And where did that take you? So you have this minimum viable product. You start building this out. You realize you don't have enough money. You go for funding. You close the funding at $2 million. Now you have to grow your team. What was the plan for the product to use that money to get you to the next step?
Well, we didn't have projects yet as a feature. We only had time. So there was a lot of product to build. So Alex and Mo, their job was to stay heads down, hire wherever you need to hire, but like build incredible products. And we started with time and we have to layer. We have to layer on projects, we have to layer on reports, we have to layer on invoicing. There's a lot of things to like build into the original product that we're still investing in today. So it was hiring. We weren't going to hire anyone for sales or operations or finance. I was already comfortable in that space. So like I was going to run it until we felt it was time. I don't think we hired, no, we hired George actually not shortly after the seed round. Mm-hmm. And George came on to help me with.
George Valdez, he's been on the show before.
Yeah, he's an incredible dear friend of mine. We hired him shortly after the seed round and we partnered together to run marketing and sales.
So where did it go from there? You have your $2 million. Building your team, building the product, you bring project into time.
Yep.
So now it's starting to become a project management tool rather than a time management tool. What year is this?
Well, we incorporated in 2019 in the spring, our round closed right around now in the fall of 2019. And I think our Series A round came about a year later.
Okay. So 2020, pandemic. How did the pandemic affect you or not really?
It did. I think it affected everyone. Originally, we were all in an office in San Francisco. And we had no intentions of ever going remote. COVID obviously changed a lot of those plans.
How many people at that time you started hiring with the money that you had?
Yeah. I think we went from 4 to 10.
Okay. So you have 10 people in an office. Now COVID hits. You have to change your plans.
Yeah. Like there was a huge pandemic going around. We had no idea what was going to happen. There were safety concerns that everyone had. Everyone was starting to debate if they wanted to stay in the city anymore. The business could continue to grow. We have to adjust our hiring plan. If we wanted to try to hire, we have to change how we work because now it's not an in-person thing and everything has to be digital and everything has to be remote and on Zoom calls and on Slack. The entire way of how we work have to change. I've even fundraised differently because like now our Series A and our first B was all done remotely on Zoom.
When was the Series A, which is the first major funding, right? So seed round, you take the money and you build a product, right? And now you have a proven product that has some traction.
Yeah.
Now you want to go for the first big round. When did you plan that and when did that happen?
So there's a thing in startups, it's called preemptive. It wasn't originally planned. Like investors, if they're doing their job well, they're watching you. And if you're doing your job as an entrepreneur, you're growing. When the stars align, they'll reach out.
So the investors will come to you and say, you need more money.
The better you perform, and I think this is not spoken about too often, but fundraising does get easier as long as you continue to perform. It's kind of like a sports team. Like things do get easier if you're a winning sports team and people are watching. And that continues to play out true even today, years and years later. That was a belief we had, and I think it's still true, which is like stay heads down, do good work. And my job as CEO is to make sure that there's enough of a news outlet that Monograph is within the investment world so I can keep the business capitalized. Index, which is a fantastic firm. They're a massive firm. They've invested in many household names already.
Who was it? Index.
Index Ventures preemptively reached out and said, we love what you guys are doing. We believe in what you're doing. We want to continue to support what we are doing.
So they were part of the original seed round?
Yes.
And so they were paying attention because they were invested.
So you learn a lot where like you kind of want early smaller checks in your prior rounds so that they can get your investor updates and they can stay close. And they have a unique advantage other than other investors who might not have, let's say, insider information.
So they were watching you grow. They came to you when and what did they say?
About a year and a half later, and they were like, we want in. We would love to lead the round. It was a $7 million round.
So Series A, first major fundraise, $7
million. Yeah, it's the first letter of the alphabet.
Yes.
And that's how fundraising, you know, kind of like sequence themselves over time. We do have two Bs, and there's a lot of reasons why you don't want the next letter before the company's ready. And that's also a learning lesson. But the A, led by Index, came about a year and a half later.
Were they the exclusive investor, or did others come in too with A?
Smaller investors came in, angels came in, Dylan at Figma came in, and then everyone who was a prior investor re-upped.
All right. And so what did the product look like when Index came to you and said, you need more money and you need to grow to the next level?
I think we finished projects, we finished tasks, we finished our directory, and we're just starting to build out invoicing. And shortly after invoicing, like payments was on the horizon. And I think that's what caught Index's like eyes. I was like, okay, we can kind of see a roadmap here. We can help you speed up that roadmap by giving you some money. And what you do is you'll use that money to hire more engineers and you can speed up the production of that roadmap. But we were already starting on invoicing as a feature before the round closed. And then we finished invoicing shortly afterwards.
So you do seed round, you did an A round. You said you did two B rounds.
Did the first B, led by Tiger Global.
And what was the trigger for that?
It was also another preemptive. They've been watching us for a long time. They're a huge investor. They have a large stake in both private and public companies.
They were a prior investor or they were just watching you?
They were not, but they had the sophisticated systems and they were watching us from afar. And we've known each other for quite some time now. So when I'm doing my job, which is networking with investors, like I meet a lot of folks, even though they're not investors, and they've been keeping tabs. This was when interest rates were effectively zero. It was also peak COVID, peak zero interest. Investments were flying off the shelf everywhere, and we participated. I have no regrets. It was an insane round. It was less than a year after the A. Tiger wanted to do a round, and we said yes.
How much was that for B?
That was a $20 million round.
$20 million for the first B?
Yeah.
And what did you do with that money?
We first celebrated.
A big party.
Yeah. And then we went back to work. Like there's a lot of work to build. And we grew the team. We grew the team actually faster than the business should have grown the team. And that was a big learning lesson for me. When the money is cheap and interest rates are low and everyone's well capitalized, staying financially accountable and financially responsible started to waver a bit.
When you have $20 million in the bank, it's easy to spend it.
Yeah, when there's a lot of money in the bank and the team is really, really small, so it felt like you can never spend it all, you start to lose some of the rigor that's required in terms of running a business. So that happened, and like we grew the team a little bit too fast, too large for what the business should have grown to. And one of the early hard mistakes that I have to learn and self-evaluate was like, now I have to fix this. We hired too many folks. And unfortunately, fix that problem meant that we had to say no to a few folks now and do our first reduction in force at the time.
Yeah, I remember that. you and I had a conversation offline about it. And I remember the struggle that you were having leading up to that.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm a young entrepreneur and I wanted to make sure that I, one, build a really good business. And I build a business where people can call home and they can do good work. I want to take care of them. This was the exact opposite. If I had to say, sorry, like you can no longer be employed here, that really hurts. And it took me a long time to be okay with that. And it took me a long time afterwards to acknowledge that and learn from it.
It sounds like they didn't do anything wrong. You made a mistake in hiring too fast.
Yeah.
And you needed to correct the mistake.
Yeah. Which I think is hard for anyone to acknowledge that like you're going to make mistakes and it's part of growing as an entrepreneur or as a business owner. It's like, when is your mistake? It's your mistake. Acknowledge it. And then it's also your responsibility to fix it.
So when you did that and you got small again, well, not necessarily small, smaller, got more efficient, did it affect the company the way you had hoped when it became more efficient?
I think every turning point for every business, as they go through hurdles and milestones, there's a takeaway. And the business naturally changes because of that. And I think that's okay. It's no different than as young adults, you live and you learn and you grow as a professional and you'll change. So I did think it did change the core of the business. And I think it changed it for a lot better. Everyone became a lot smarter and a lot more in tune. And not only me, but the entire business made better decisions. That only compounds. And like I'm so proud of the team today because it continues to compound. You have to go through hard and situations and struggles, learn from those struggles, and then you roll them into your toolkit and you make better decisions the next time you do it.
Also, somewhere along the line, your partners exited the company, right?
About 2 years ago.
Your co-founders. What was the cause of that and how did that go?
Well, both of them started families. Being an entrepreneur, being a founder is really hard. It's hard on your partners. It's hard on you. It's hard on your physical state. It's hard on your mental state. They got tired and they needed to take some time off. And they weren't going to come back after the time off. And I think those were also hard discussions.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to bring it up. I mean,
yeah.
How did you have those conversations? How did that happen? Did they come to you or?
Yes, they came to me. But I think that's why it's so important to build a relationship with your partners, your business partners, so that you can feel comfortable whenever you're having a hard time, because you're not perfect. And whenever you make mistakes, you're not perfect. And whenever you think you gotta make a big decision and why, and you should feel comfortable talking about it, even though it's an uncomfortable topic.
Yeah. When did that happen in the timeline?
I think it started around spring of 2023.
So after the initial B round?
After the B, about a year and a half later. So it was a hard one. I think we've learned really, really quick that like shouldn't hire so fast. When you study your profit loss and income statements, like the numbers just look completely upside down. And you have to learn what a utilization rate is, what your burn multiple is, which is great for me. I've learned essentially how to read a P&L and how to manage the finances of a scaling business, how much to push the limits and where does it just starts to like not look achievable anymore. But to course correct that afterwards also took a toll, not just on me, but on the entire company, including my two co-founders. So 2023, we sat down and they shared, you know, the news that like, hey, like this might not, I'm tired and I have a family and I want, would like to take a break and would like to try something else. I was like, great. Thank you for telling me. As long as you don't leave immediately and we can establish a transition plan, then let's figure that out.
Yeah. So that was a couple of years ago. After first B round, you said you had a second B round.
That's the most recent one. It closed last year, led by Base 10 towards the end. And then we announced it the beginning of this year.
Beginning of this year. And how much was that?
That was another 20 million.
So 20 and 20. And why a second B round and not a C round?
So there are historically benchmarks for what rounds should be called based on the performance and the stage a business has achieved. Most A's are usually around after the $1 million in annual recurring revenue. B's typically happens after the 5 million, closing in on the 10 million. Which means a letter C is somewhere around $25, $30 million as a business. If you haven't achieved that benchmark yet and call yourself a Series C, there are risks in terms of is sending the wrong message.
Yeah.
That's like telling someone I'm a college student, but I'm still in high school.
Yeah.
You can do that. It is not advisable because it sets the wrong benchmark.
So there's an expectation that comes with that letter. And if you haven't yet built a company to that level, it could become a problem.
It could be because it's a signaling problem for investors and it's the wrong benchmark. I'll go back to the same analogy. If you're truly a high school student, but calling yourself a college student, it sends the wrong signal and it sets the wrong benchmark.
So now second B round, a lot more money. Where are you now? What does Monograph look like today in terms of the product as well as the team?
Well, I'm really excited. We're almost 100 people. So the business has scaled drastically in a much healthier rate. The business has also grown from a revenue perspective substantially over the last 12 months, and it's growing faster every single quarter. So we're doing incredibly well. The original vision of how we solve a timesheet problem, a project management problem, an invoicing problem, and a payments problem is almost to the point where I would be very happy at. And we've just started to kick off this year around collaboration, which is the second phase of my vision for Monograph. And that part will be highly difficult to continue to build, but it is the next phase of what I would call an operating system. But this operating system includes all the other stakeholders that are involved in making a building happen. It starts with architects, but it does not end with architects. Obviously, there's structural engineers, mechanical, seismic, geothermal, electrical, civil, landscape, sound, acoustics. Then there's a bidding process, a permitting process, a procurement process. Then there's general contractors and subcontractors. The vision ideally incorporates everyone over time. It will take time. And I think the way we're going to attack this problem is one step at a time. What's amazing about architecture is it's highly linear, right? It's one step after another. We go from SD to DD, DD to CD, CD to CA. And each of the stakeholders are also sequentially following after each other. This is essentially our business roadmap and our product roadmap. We'll build as much as we can, as fast as we can along the way. It will take us many years until we get to the very end.
Yeah. What a journey.
I've signed up for the rest of my life to work on Monograph.
Yeah. It's been fun to watch you grow and succeed and struggle and then succeed again. It's been interesting and enlightening. As an entrepreneur myself, it's been fun to watch Monograph grow. I'm excited for you as a friend. And so, yeah, thanks for sharing the story.
Happy to. I don't think we've had a chance to share the whole story yet. And I feel like I'm still in chapter one.
Yeah, it's very early on, right? It's still very early on. Especially with the vision that you have. This is very, very early in the company if you achieve that vision. So very, very early.
I'm really grateful because I think shortly after Alex and Mo have decided to step aside, I've learned how to step up. And I think that was one of the biggest learnings about 2 years ago. And now I feel really, really comfortable being not just a founder, but truly a CEO of the scaling business.
If you could go back to that initial timesheet business and tell yourself one thing, what would that one thing be that you would tell yourself as a young entrepreneur?
Oh my God, that's a tough one. There's a lot of things I would do differently. I truly believe that starting a business, you need co-founders. It's just really, really hard. And Mark, you and I have talked about that numerous times, that starting a business is incredibly hard without co-founders. And like most things, I would acknowledge are short-sighted if you don't complete the sentence. At the end of the day, there can only be one CEO and only one person in charge. The business will move a lot faster if you step into that role. I think consensus thinking or committee thinking, it sounds good, almost utopic, but extraordinarily bad and slow when trying to execute and grow a business.
Yeah, that would be good advice for the young Robert Yoon.
Yes. Like, have partners, but also acknowledge what role you play.
Yeah.
And if you are the CEO, then hey, be the CEO. Like, you got to make decisions a little bit faster. And the reason why you want to make decisions faster is so that you can make mistakes faster. It won't be caveat here. Like, this doesn't apply to all business models. Like, I would not suggest this if you're trying to start an architecture business. But if you're venture backed and you have the finances and an account that allows you to make mistakes, your only objective then is to make as many mistakes as fast as possible with the objective to make less mistakes over time. But the only thing you can do is make those decisions faster, or you don't learn. Like, your learning cycle is correlated to how fast you make these decisions. So if your learning cycles is 12 months, then you only have 12-month cycles to essentially learn if you did it, it did well, or did it bad. If you can cut that cycle by half, which is like you learning every 6 months, then you get 2 cycles within 1 year, which is amazing. If you cut it in half again, now your learning cycles are quarters every 3 months. The trick is to get it down to so fast that you feel comfortable with, and you can still have enough learnings out of it that success compounds.
Very interesting. All right. You are trained as an architect. You are an entrepreneur. You work with thousands of architects now. You've done surveys and data collection. And so you know architects very, very well. So final question, what's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Don't forget to raise your rates.
Very good advice. His name is Robert Yoon. Company is Monograph. Monograph.com is where you can go learn more and sign up and do all the things. Robert, thank you. Thanks for the dedication that you have given to this community of architects. The product is important, but your dedication to the community, you've come here to the podcast multiple times. You've shared your knowledge at the Entre Architect Network membership several times. You've shared your knowledge with me privately and in publicly many, many times. Thank you for giving and for sharing your knowledge with our community. And thank you for coming by here today and sharing the story of Monograph at Entre Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure.
If you liked this episode of Entre Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entre Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entre Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entre Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entre Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entre Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entre Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entre Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.